Mr. Holden, we thought we'd better talk to you a bit this afternoon because Michigan State College is taking interest now in establishing a foundation relating to the history of corn that might collect materials for the library that relate to the history of corn and corn research and corn processing, museum materials that would illustrate methods of raising corn and grinding corn and baking corn and art objects. And because of your very important position as a link between William J. Beale, who began the first hybridization of corn, and the later man, East and others, who carried the hybridization of corn to completion, it seemed important this afternoon that we talk to you about your role in it. I'm interested, however, in the fact that you spent not your whole life on hybridizing corn. You spent most of your life talking to farmers and trying to tell them how to farm. Is there any percentage in trying to tell a farmer who's farmed all his life how a professor would farm if he had a chance to farm?
Well, yes, I very decidedly feel that there is, or I wouldn't have spent so much of my life trying to improve the conditions on the farm. If you don't mind, I would like to answer for a minute or two a question that has been put up to me many, many times. And that is, Holden, why are you wearing yourself out trying to talk to farmers and improve their conditions, and why anybody can farm? Well, that's just the trouble. They've allowed anybody to farm. Now, I wish to make one or two statements that will perhaps give you a better foundation for judging why I have given much of my life to this effort to improve agriculture. In the first place, agriculture is the one industry which makes every other industry. Let me repeat that again. Agriculture is the one industry which makes every other business, no matter what your business may be. And second, let us remember that your business can prosper or succeed only in proportion as the farmer's business succeeds. If corn was cut out of the United States today, our factories would stop, our automobiles and everywhere would factories would be idle. Every business would slow clear down. In other words,
do you mean corn is more important than wheat?
Yeah, insofar as its relations to our prosperity. Mm-hmm. Corn's what's made our superiority over Russia and over Europe. Every other business licenses. The doctor, the minister, the lawyer, and the veterinarian that treats your cat, takes care of them. But who licenses the farmer? Mm-hmm. Anybody can farm. Mm-hmm. And everyone's business is dependent on that agriculture. It's fundamental. That's what prompts me. And then the other phase of it is that what is the result? Why, better humanity. Of course, the human being is the final end in all my interest. And corn, I can get a hold of him because here's his business. Here's the thing that makes it possible. And I always carried corn in my grip. If I had him here now, I'd do better.
Maybe we should go and get one for you.
Well, now, let's see. We'll go back then. Then I won't take any more time, only to remark that the great problem is to take care of this farm, this agriculture. Well, there's no agriculture going to the deserts of Nevada and Arizona. No one living there, no industry, no nothing. That's what we'll have, just in proportion. You go from here north, and you see the difference in the living, the homes and everything. You just step into the sandy region and so forth, you can tell it's the looks of houses. In other words, there can be no greater prosperity in business, and as people think of business, than there is in agriculture. If agriculture isn't prosperous, then there isn't any such thing as prosperity.
And you devoted much of your career, as I understand it, to persuading farmers to raise more bushels of corn per acre, particularly by carefully selecting their corn seed and by testing the corn seed in the very famous Holden testers, and that in producing more corn through the gospel seed train, gospel trains, I'm sorry, that you directed in Iowa at the beginning of the century, and the work that you did for International Harvester, now finally in the production of corn, one of the great steps in the last few years has been the introduction of hybrid seed corn, which has increased the yields of the old corn belts and made it possible to raise corn in parts of Michigan and Minnesota that never before produced it. Increased production to the point that the effects of soil exhaustion and the like have been more than counterbalanced. That through hybrid seed corn, through the hybridization of seed corn, we have found that it is possible to increase yield, increase the strength of the stalk, its resistance to drought, to disease, to bugs. And in all of that, Michigan State College had a peculiar place. In 1876, William James Beale was beginning to think about the possibilities of crossbreeding corn, and he spoke at the Traverse City Institute. Now, I believe you attended that institute in 1877.
That is correct.
Where did you live then?
I lived at that time in Benzie County, about 15 miles west of Traverse City. The institute was held at Traverse City, and it made a great impression on me because it was the first institute I'd ever attended.
Now, what was an institute?
That is where the farmers, the law provides for the holding of institutes in any county where the farmers take an interest and so forth, and these were being held throughout the state, and one of them was located at Traverse City, and that furnished me the opportunity to hear Dr. Beale, Dr. Kedzie.
Yes, and Dr. Beale suggested that there were some great opportunities in crossbreeding corn.
Well, he put it this way. He said, what would you think of a farmer who would buy a fine heifer out here and then go and to get a scrub bull? And he didn't perceive that very much, because up there there probably wasn't 40 acres of corn within 10 miles of Traverse City. And so it was dropped there, but it made a tremendous impression on me.
Now, what's the significance of this bull and the heifer and corn?
Yes, well, and he did make this remark, that's what you do with your corn.
Now, how do you mean that?
Well,
which is the heifer?
He said, when you, what did you think of a man that would go, buy a good heifer and then get a scrub bull for the father, for the service? And he says, but that's what you do with your corn.
Now, is the ear of corn, that's the mother?
That's
and
the mother.
The pollen is
pollen
the father?
Pollen is for the male. Comes drifting from everywhere, you see.
Oh, yes.
You see.
And he thought they ought to select pollen.
They ought to control that, and so as to not allow that pollen from the scrubs. Often a barren stalk will produce a lot of pollen. Now, you're breeding for barrenness, and it may be the worst kind of a scrub.
And then the seed that you plant from that ear of corn will produce barren corn.
More or less, yes. Heredity, laws act, and of course you're going to have, and that's, and so Dr. Beale tried to convince people that they should do something about it, and he told them about how he had planted two varieties of corn side by side, then gone through and pulled the tassels all out of one row, and then left them on the next row, so that every other row had them pulled out. That is, those that one variety were pulled out, those on the others not. Well, then that made him cross them. And here the yield was above anything else that either of the others, and it was quite a puzzle.
Now, this is the first appearance of hybrid vigor in corn.
Yes, that was the first time it was brought out, so that if anyone knew it before, they
I'm
didn't.
Sorry. They didn't publish.
No, it's the first on record.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's Darwin's connection with this?
Well, Darwin conducted an experiment on inbreeding, but it was very crude. It was done in a greenhouse, and he allowed that pollen to just go where it was a mind to, and yet he did enough so that he concluded that that wasn't the direction for improving corn, and he gave up any effort to go farther with inbreeding. And Beale, in the same way, he got the crossing, but that he didn't. He couldn't think that that you could go the other way and get ahead.
Yes, and of course, to go through a field and cut the tassels off the corn,
why
raise the cost of production?
That and besides, you'd have to hire a lot of people to help, and they'd tear down more corn, and it was expensive, and all of that.
No.
So and that's what puzzled him. Well, then there were so many students come to college that Beale had to give up his horticultural work and some of those things and drop these things in order to take care of all these students, you see.
But when you came to Michigan State as a student,
yes,
he was still working with hybrid corn?
Well, yeah, he was, but he dropped it very soon because of his other works. I say mm-hmm. Our class is a very large class. And it had four or five sections, you see. And but we came in contact with the work because Dr. Beale wanted someone to look after his windows and see they'll shut down. And in order to compensate him, we went out and harvested his corn. Took the sacks off, you know, in August, when the school opened, you know, used to open in August. Took the sacks off. And helped harvest the corn. So we got an early introduction into it. Then from that time on, his time was so taken that he couldn't give very much time to the corn.
Why did you come to Michigan State as a student?
Undoubtedly it was because of that talk that he made at Traverse City. That gave me, headed me in this way. And then later there were neighbors, boys came down here, Thurtells other neighbors there, two or three of them. But the main thing was the interest that I got in.
Now, you lived with the Beales while you were in college?
That is true in a sense. Of course, we went to Dr. Beale's the first thing because we felt we had a little connection. And Dr. Beale hadn't gotten up yet in the morning. And Mrs. Beale, fine mother lady that she was, a woman, invited us in to eat pancakes. In the meantime, Dr. Beale came out and looked us over and said, new students.
This is you and your brother?
E. Ellsworth, mm-hmm. Yes. My brother Ellis, we both came same time. And later we went to see him again on another occasion, and Mrs. Beale turned to Dr. Beale and said, why don't you give the boys a room over in your laboratory, in a botanical laboratory upstairs, and let them get a stove and cook their meals and board themselves. He kind of looked around funny and said, that's the way I got my start. And so we went, in order to sort of pay for that, we took care of his corn, got his samples for the senior classes and gathered all that sort of stuff. We sort of in assistance.
Yes. Now, where had you been living before you moved into the botanical laboratory?
We'd been living in room 18, in Bedbug Alley, Williams Hall.
I see. Now, where would you get a name like that?
Well, the bedbugs were there. I never saw anything like it. But this next time, when I got a little ahead in the story there, when we went the second time, Dr. Beale said, "Where are you rooming?" And said, "Room 18, and Williams Hall." He kind of grinned, and he knew very well their reputation. That's where Mrs. Beale came in to it and says, "Well, here, why don't you give them boys?"
this was to get you away from the bugs.
Oh, now, but that was a part of it.
That's a part of the story of Beale to Holden to East, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Now, where was the Botanical Laboratory?
The Botanical Laboratory stood south of Abbott Hall, before you cross the ditch, that right down the bank.
Old Abbott.
Drop down, yes, Old Abbott.
At the Wild Garden, Botanical Garden.
Before you drop down into the Wild Garden, right up on the bank there.
Yes, and where were the corn plots?
The corn plots, used to be professor of horticulture, you know, too. And he had some out in the field out there, east of the college grounds. Out now it's covered with buildings.
Yes, before.
But there was what was known as the diamond, triangular piece of ground where Michigan Avenue comes up, and then the road comes off on Michigan Avenue to go around the north side. There was no north side.
That old delta.
Yes, the old delta in there, and that he cleared off for his, grasses. Mm-hmm. See, he was making a grass book, and laid off in plots. Well, he had quite a few that extra, so he'd plant some of his corn in there, and that's where we found them.
I see.
And so from that time on, he didn't to take... He couldn't give much time and really dropped the question. Not that he wasn't interested, and he was very much interested in Darwin's work. He was a great believer in Darwin. But none of the persons, as far as I know, no one followed up this inbreeding stuff. He got his dose the first time and satisfied. And of course, I had an advantage in this, in one way, that Professor Davenport and I were particular friends, for reasons which I will not stop to explain here. But we'd worked together under Beale all my junior and senior year, under Dr. Beale, and Davenport has taken his advanced degree then too, and so was made kind of an assistant botany. And when he went to Illinois, of course he left us and went to Brazil, but when he came back, he was made appointed as professor, as dean of the College of Agriculture of the University of Illinois.
And now, before you went to Illinois, you had been assistant to the professor of agriculture.
Yes, that's right. I forgot. I overlooked that.
Well, that's quite all right. You mustn't. That's part of your career.
Yes.
And we have they turned up in the farm crops department the other year or so ago. Professor Decker did a book of which I have here now. Of experiments in the farm department in 1891, 92, 90, which were conducted apparently under a Professor Holden. It says Perry G. Holden, head of farm crops. Mm-hmm. And these experiments, there are a great many, many of them relate to corn, but they were carried on by students in your classes in agriculture.
They were, that's right.
For you were really the professor of farm crops.
Yes,
that's what I wanted. And these experiments, I have gone through them rather carefully, and I'm quite startled because here are the very experiments that Beale had carried on earlier, repeated with greater care,
yes,
and elaborate reports, even diaries on how the corn looked on July 17th and how it looked on July 18th, and the conclusions that the yield is much better. But as one of the students reported, and I'm sure he got some advice perhaps from the professor on this, his conclusion was that while the yield of corn is greatly increased by crossbreeding two different corns, that it isn't economical to send someone through the field.
Yes.
But now, when you left here in 1893,
1895. When I left here in 93, you're right.
Yes, and then
correct.
You went back.
Yeah, then,
and then you went to Illinois. Yeah, right? When you left here in 18, why did you leave here? Isn't Michigan State a fine institution?
Or
doesn't it appreciate good men? Which is it?
Well, there's one good reason for leaving, that I was fired along with my brother-in-law.
Well, tell us about it.
Well, and Professor Davenport had gone to Brazil, and that left us without any Professor of Agriculture. Professor Burnett, who afterwards became my brother-in-law, and I had to run things.
Burnett became president of Nebraska,
yes,
chancellor.
Yes, he did. And we were greatly interested, if possible, in getting Professor Davenport appointed to the professorship in agriculture. And, well, in the meantime, the board had hired a man graduate from Massachusetts Agricultural College, and he proved to be very unsatisfactory. Students didn't like him, and he thought that someone must be working against him. Well, my brother-in-law, Professor Burnett, thought that we ought to go over and advise with the president. The president had been advised by his doctor. The report came out in the paper that the president was advised by a doctor to resign and go to Florida for his health. And, well, we took that, as we naturally would, in good faith. We supposed that was, we didn't know the ways of things so well in those days. And the president, Clute, immediately assumed that we had probably had helped get him out of here. And Professor Harwood, he was all ready to say that he was sure we worked against him. And so the first thing we knew, out of the blue sky came an edict asking Professor Burnett to resign. And he did. About a month or so later, I got a note from the board asking me to come over to the board meeting, and said, Mr. Holden, we'd like to have you resign. I said, I'm not going to resign. I said, you can fire me if you want to, but and that's what I got. You see, President Davenport appointed me to take this over, this number one job of the institution, that's student labor. And so when they'd been hauling hog manure, that's my first job, was on hog manure. And
on a hot day?
And a hot day in August on the south side, that's sitting there all summer. That was the way that all the boys had to go through this sort of stuff. And it was distasteful.
3 hours a day, five?
2 hours and a half. 2 hours and a half every day, except on Saturday and Sunday. And and professors had been fired because of the troubles they'd get into. And students didn't like it, and they'd cheat and get out of it, and leave in the middle of the afternoon before their time was up, and everything. And always having a rumpus. And finally, Professor Johnson was gotten out, and through Professor Burnett's influence, and especially the work that I did, Butterfield, where his father was secretary of the college, And we only got Johnson out, which was my senior year. We'd done that 4 years of that, and it had been going 4 years or more before I even went there. And I don't want to try to tell you how we saved the institution in the most critical time, but it would have been a very different looking institution maybe today if it hadn't been that we went to the board and told them that every student would leave within 48 hours unless they rescinded their order firing Heimbaugh, because he wouldn't tell who put H2S in Johnson's classroom. So, and then when they called, we went down and met the board before they got out of town. Told them a story. He said, we might want to be fair with you and all, but here's what'll happen. Now, there's no bluff about this at all. This has all been thought out, and we aren't going to stay here and see the boys fired like that. And for the seniors had agreed to go, and the juniors, well, that left the sophomores in our class. Well, Harry Thurdell, who was a neighbor of ours up in Michigan, just lived over in the adjoining district in Leelanau County, it was a sophomore. And I went to him and I said, what are you doing? Going to do anything? Going to stand by the boys? See them fired like that? And, well, he says, here's your class. Got more students in it than all the others put together. They'll get along pretty well and won't mind it. And I said, how do you know we're going to? I said, have you people got the nerve to put up with it? I said, I think our class will decidedly decide to go somewhere else. I said, you can call them if you want to. You can call ours. And then there was Breger, who was loved by all the students. He acted as a liaison between us going to our meeting and then over to theirs and back and forth. And when he got through, appointed a committee to go down and just tell the board. Well, first appointed the committee and all that. And then I suggested, well, let's not just jump put the things on until we've given the board a chance. Let's just go down and tell them exactly the facts. And we did. And Luce, who was not governor then, but he was a member of the Board of Agriculture, but became governor later. He said, boys, I think I can take it upon myself to speak for the board and say that we'll come back and take another and review this case. And happy you'll go home and hold your horses and give us a chance to come back. And they did come back. But the seniors had passed a resolution. It was only 2 weeks till graduation. The seniors had passed a resolution saying they would not graduate, you see, unless Heimbaugh was reinstated. Well, when the board came back, they considered Heimbaugh's case and reinstated him. Asked the seniors to rescind. And sent over and asked them for rescind. Supposed, of course, they'd do it, but they had a meeting and still was cocky, and by God, it was 18 out of the 32 refused. Next morning, they called them in one at a time. You're dismissed. 18 of them never got their diplomas. Hmm. Now, we couldn't back that up, you see. But just firing that man Heimbaugh because he wouldn't tell, that stirred us all. And we'd all left too. But I just, that you're the historian and that might be of interest in your...
Well, that...
Now this, let's see.
Now the point, then, yes, when you took over the direction of labor under Davenport here in 91 and 2, you tried to give the students educational labor instead of just back-breaking hot work in the fields and the like, so that they might learn something about the science of agriculture as well as how to pitch manure.
Yes.
And well, I'm very interested in those corn experiments because they show Beale's work going on 20 years
yes.
after, 15 years
yes.
after he began it.
And when I went back to, when I went to Illinois, Professor Davenport had asked me to come and accept a position there, and the institution had been running for 35 years, and they had 13 students registered in agriculture. And so Professor Davenport wanted to know if I wouldn't come and help him get this thing started. And so I agreed to go, accepted the position, but I couldn't get rid of these other jobs right at the minute. So I would promise to come the next year to start my work there. But it so happened that the train was a little late leaving after we'd had all our conferences. And Professor Davenport turned to me while we were waiting and said, "Holden, is there something that we could do to help you get started?" And it flashed through my mind suddenly that, why, here's Mr. Frazier, that has been helping with corn work here at the college. He could go and plant inbreed some of that corn. And I was just starting, I think, to tell about the going to train.
Yes, and you had made some plans about planting corn.
Yes. And now let's see.
Someone was going to plant these corn.
Oh, yes, Professor Frazier, yes. He was to, yes, I don't know whether that was recorded or not, but I don't want to repeat here, but.
Go right ahead.
That's all right.
You'll take care of it.
The Professor Davenport turned to me and said, "Mr. Holden, is there something we can do to help you?" And then it occurred to me that here was Professor Frazier that could make the first inbreedings, you see, so that I'd gain a year, because I couldn't go till the next year.
Why were you interested in inbreeding corn at that point?
Well, that was carried over clear from up here. That is a thing that I wanted to do while with these students, but the sophomores came one year, the next year they'd be over as juniors. You see, skip a year, every other year, and you couldn't make it consecutive. It made it a little difficult to go continue right through a period of years, which is necessary in breeding.
And now, they had been working, and Beale had been working with crossbreeding.
Oh, yes, entirely.
And now you are going to use the pollen from the same stalk to fertilize an ear of
yes. So that, yes, boy, that it would be what we truly call inbreeding in corn, the pollen from the stalk's tassel put on its own silk.
Mm-hmm. Now, how is that done?
Well, this is done by putting a sack over the ear shoot before the silks quite appear, so there's no danger of any pollen getting on them. Put a silk sack over the tassel. And then when the pollen is ready and the silk are out, take this all loose and open the oven, duck it on here and fertilize it with this. Later, we learn to run a tube in up there instead of having to pull it off and suck it in and then blow it into the hole in the other thing.
Very good.
Yes, and then it's more accurate too. See, we didn't give any chance for a lot of other pollen to fall on. And I'm glad I didn't know that in the first place, because I might not have discovered the important thing that I finally did discover.
What was that?
Now, well, that was this, that after when I, see, I'm jumping now clear just over from that other, and I'm missing the cog, but the, I'm trying to see how we can splice it on there, but, well, anyway, the, see, I had to put this pollen on here. And then, well, now next year when I went back there, or really next spring, I couldn't go in the spring, but I had him take some of this inbred, here's where the point is, he had inbred this corn once one year. Well, now that, then the kernels from that cross, you see, that inbreeding, not a cross, but inbreeding,
yes,
was what he planted next year. Then in the next spring, I had him plant that, and then again take some pollen from a tassel and put on.
So that it was self-fertilized
twice. Twice right there. Mm-hmm. You see how much I was gaining.
Yes.
And then 1906, when I went back, here was these fields of corn, that just as they were photographed in that book.
Now as you inbred those corns, what happened? Did the ears grow bigger and better?
No, it's very noticeable that that when we planted this inbred corn, this had been crossed, that the stalks were much smaller and inferior, and the ears smaller, and it looked as though it was useless.
And that's because it's going back to its ancestral stocks.
Yes, getting rid of all the things that's been added by so-called civilization.
And you didn't publish the reports of these experiments?
I might go a little farther, I think, with the other point.
Yes. Yet.
And that is this. I spoke about, it was fortunate perhaps that I didn't do too good a job of pollination. That's what I wanted to splice onto. Because when in doing this, occasionally some pollen from somewhere else would get on. Well, when one of them got a spear of pollen from somewhere else, well, that stalk shot way up. I couldn't, that looked strange to me. But I couldn't help but think that it must have gotten me. Well, you can see it's pretty hard to keep this pollen all separate entirely. So here would be case and the stalks going way up.
There was hybrid vigor again.
Yes, there was. And, well, then I still kept on crossing, or inbreeding. And then I thought, well, I'll just take now and plant one of these, and then I'll, instead of waiting for some strange pollen to happen to fall in, I'll see that some pollen does come from across. And my gracious, the way that stuff went up, that was beginning to open my eyes. And then finally I said, I believe I'll just cross two of these little runts down here. One over here had been bred down around, and I think that'll finish the thing. To my surprise, that stuff went up there to clear up of anything else, fine great ears. And why, you just simply, if I'd tell you about it, and I didn't have the photographs and all, I wouldn't have believed it. You can see why I didn't go and try to publish or tell the story when this stuff was all supposed to have been gone up in the fire, you see. All this material, and I'll just take the time here to say, to explain a little bit. At that time, farmers were suspicious of the college. They didn't believe that anybody could show them how to farm, and they were particularly opposed to their own agricultural college down there, and the fact that for 35 years they only had 13 or 14 students registered in agriculture. They hadn't any use for the institution. And they'd already had two cases of premature publicity that put them in awfully bad on chinch bugs and on making sugar out of corn. And that was in the air. And so Professor Davenport and the president said, we don't want any more of that publicity business. That's bringing the institution into disgrace among the very people that we should be friendly with. And Davenport turns to me and says, "Holden, I guess it's up to you." Well, I said, "All right." So I locked up everything. As fast as I got any data or anything, I locked it up. In fact, I didn't tell even Shamel about this stuff, only here's something to do, but I didn't try to.
Now, who is Shamel?
Shamel was one of my assistants. He was one of those 13 students that we found there. He was a sophomore, and he became tremendously interested. Stayed all one summer without any salary just to be able to work with me. And I'd go out in the morning oftentimes and do this pollination work, you see. And then maybe at night I'd go out there, so as to keep it as quiet as possible, because I was under obligations. I'd promised to keep it quiet.
And of course, if the members of the legislative committee had seen some of the ears of corn from your inbred lines, they would have thought they had a real crackpot professor, wouldn't they?
They'd have been perfectly justified in saying, "Hold on, get out of here." They would have, I wouldn't have blamed them. In fact, I think if I had been appealed to me before this and I'd seen this, I would have opposed, I'd have said nothing to it. In fact, one of the professors made this remark. He said, "There is no purpose in this sort of thing. It's a waste of the people's money." Professor Davenport, I was fortunate in having Professor Davenport back with me, because we had agreed that I would take and run this thing down into the ground somewhere and find out where the end of it was. And I said, "Well, then, what you'll stay with me, and I'll keep the records."
And why had you been inbreeding the corn again?
To discover some method of control, pollen control of breeding, so that in a practical way we could use this crossing to give vigor and strength and increase the yield. And it didn't look very encouraging going down to these little nubbins. Why, the fourth and fifth year, the little ears are quite big on your finger, about this high. They
18 inches high.
Yes, 18, 20 inches high. And, when I crossed those two down there, that was the thing that opened it up. Well, first, those occasional ones that got in, you know, I could see that what they did to it. And then I went on and purposely conducted one, which one of them I knew was inbred, and the other was ordinary corn, you see. Put that pollen up. Well, the way it went up. And now, of course, they have adopted the double cross idea, so that here's a cross way down here and here's a cross. Put those two together, it'll carry over for one generation, and that's what made it commercially possible. And that's what Donald F. Jones put into the thing that turned the key that finally unlocked it. Now, but you can readily see this, I'm sure, that if someone hadn't have done this inbreeding, there could have been no hybrid corn.
Well, that's the next thing that I'd like to hear about. Yeah. That is the inbred lines of corn, which you began at Illinois, which Fraser began, yeah, under your instructions, yeah, and which you carried on, became the inbred lines which were used by East in his crossing?
They were used, of course, by him, yes. He was one of my assistants, and he was in the chemistry department.
That's Hopkins.
No, but East, yes. Hopkins was head of the experimental chemistry, you see. Mm-hmm. And but, of course, he was doing, that was a part of the agricultural department there. And East, and then there was Love, and Love was assistant in the chemical laboratory, Funk Brothers, up at Bloomington. And I was interested in coming down and taking interest in this inbreeding. So he helped East, and then Shamel, and once up, maybe quite a bunch, that was carrying this thing right on. Mm-hmm. Well, that's where it went for. There isn't any question about it. But nobody ever seemed to go farther than to find out that the inbreeding hurt the corn. Mm-hmm. And if I'd had any sense, well, of course I'd.
You had something else to do, probably, besides just that, too.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
You're a professor of agronomy?
Yes. I was elected there professor of agronomy. That's the first agronomy department ever established in the United States. Mm-hmm. Was there.
That is, you were the first professor of agronomy.
First professor of agronomy,
appointed.
And that's the first department that mm-hmm. was equipped and fitted out. Iowa afterwards adopted it in Nebraska. In fact, going all over, this institution never has. About only one or two or three didn't adopt that, the idea of agronomy. So that you didn't have to say about crops or soils or this or that. It's like 4-H Club. It took care of the whole bunch. Mm-hmm. Animal husbandry, it takes care of a whole bunch. Well, and so when I went there, Professor Davenport had figured out we'd call it agricultural physics. And I was elected associate professor of agricultural physics. But the thing didn't spark. And so they got talking me over one day, apparently, and I met Dr. Burrell out on Burrell Avenue, south of the Union Building there. Dr. Burrell said, Holden, we've got to do something to hold you down. We've got too much energy here. He said, how'd you like to be professor of agronomy? Dr. Beale always scratched his head like this when anything new come up like that. And well, then after he asked that question, I scratched my head. And I looked up, see, he wasn't joking. And I said, well, doctor, I don't know what that thing is, but I'll take it if you'll let me define it. I said that would be clover soils and crops and farm machinery and farm management. He said, ha 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 ha, I said, I guess that'll do. The upshot of it was that it went into the report the professor put in, and oh, that's a story in itself. The president happened to sail for Europe just in time. And in the meantime, this thing was put up, and Professor Davenport's recommendations hadn't been submitted to the board. The president was opposing all of this stuff. He didn't think. President Draper said when he accepted the position, I'll digress enough to say this, and it ought to be in your report. When Dr. Draper was offered the position of president there, he asked the board to give him a night to sleep on it. Question. In the morning he came back and he said, I have decided to accept the position under one condition, that I will not be responsible for the success of the College of Agriculture. Well, they only had 13 students after 35 years.
There's no success to be responsible for.
No. And he said, why, you know, boys are coming down here, students that take 4 years, of course, to farm. And he says, I don't think they need to either. That's what Dan Boyce and I were up against. Well, finally, we got the appropriations through. That's a wonderful story, too. We shaved off across the line sometime. And President Draper, when I had to go out and take care of what took me away from the institution was this sugar beet factory that we had helped encourage. And the man that was superintendent of agriculture had made a failure of it, and the farmers were dissatisfied, and it looked to me as though I ought to go out and try to straighten it up. They'd asked me to. And that took me away from this experiment right at the time when I hated
it. That was what year then?
That was in 1900.
And you left the University of Illinois to go to work. And then
the sugar company.
The sugar company.
Yeah.
And then later you went to work for the
Funks?
The Funks,
yes. I organized the Funks, really. Of course, I always speak of it as going to help them and so forth, but I really organized it. And
their seed company.
Yes, their seed company. I was a manager.
And that was primarily seed corn.
Yeah, seed. Yes, that was this seed corn proposition, and I had 10% of the profits besides my salary, and of course corn is what I wanted. And now this isn't recording, is it?
Yes, fine. We want all this. It's part of the story. And then you went from there to Iowa.
Yes, they. I did. That's exactly what I did in 1902. And when I went at 1902.
Let's see, 1900 to the sugar company.
Yeah.
Sugar beet. And 19 what? To
Funks? 19 one, part of one and two.
At Funks.
Funks.
And then 1902 to Iowa.
And then 1902 to Iowa, yes, the State College. And to organize another agronomy department. And in fact, I drew the plans for the whole agronomy department at Ames forever I had any notion of going there.
And then you went on there, you developed the Corn Gospel trains and an extension department, and then with International Harvester to head their extension department. In what year?
That was 1912.
And you were there for?
For 20 years.
20 years. And thus the corn lines, the inbred corn that you had developed at Illinois, is left in other people's hands.
Yes.
Now
we started it, the Funks went on there. I set up the machinery for their inbreeding, and now it's the most important, it's the most extensive corn breeding, hybrid corn breeding plant in the world.
Well, what about these gospel trains? I'm sure many people don't know exactly what they were at that time.
Very glad to say a few words about that, because I regard it as a very important part of my work. It became very apparent to me with the attitude that farmers had at that time towards college professors and the idea that farmers could get anything out of a college professor that was practical value. I could see that I'd got to sell corn to the people. They treated corn as hog food. And that's just common corn. Yes, I said, your children are just common children. But aren't they important? I said, well, here's the most important crop in the world. And I just, it made me sore. And, well, now that's, you want me to tell a little bit about that story? Well, it's a case of taking opportunities as they come along. They'd had a bad fall before, and the corn had been frozen before it was ripe. And the next winter, I was pretty shy of it. I'd had too much corn. We were growing 8,000 acres on the Funk farms, but for 2-3 years before, in the sugar business, I had 1,000 acres. And so I went out and gathered up corn. I had the grain dealers from over the northwestern part of Iowa, where it was hit the worst, send in 10-ear samples. In a given community, the three different farmers would send me each 10 ears of their seed corn. I put it in the germination box, took 6 kernels out of each ear, and put them into a box about this big.
About how big would that be?
Just there. It's 30 inches.
About 30 inches.
Allowed me to have 10 squares through in one row, and then the next row, and 10 rows, they have sort of room for 100 ears. Take 6 kernels out of ear one, put it up in there, out of 2 in there, and then so on right through. And then I took these corn.
Now, what was in the box? That dirt?
We use sawdust, because it holds the moisture well, and you could always get enough around the ice house and so forth, that it's always easy to get. And I'd moisten that sawdust, put it in a sack, and let it moisten overnight in warm water. Then the next day, I'd take it out and tramp it and get the excessive moisture out. Put about 1.5 inches in this box, which was 2 inches or 3 inches deep. Put 1.5 inches of it right in on the bottom. Then lay up that checkered cloth that was ruled off.
Oh, into squares.
Yes, in squares. Lay that right on top of it. Tack it a little at the end. There, then here was a checkerboard, mm-hmm. You see. And 6 kernels from each ear, you could count them right through. Mr. Smith's corn, Mr. Jones's corn, Mr. Brown's corn, and so on.
Then you covered the corn with...
Then took another cloth that was putting as big as this table, not quite as big, and laid that right over the whole thing, and put sawdust, moist sawdust right on top of that. And then put it over and covered it up, and let's leave it a week. And those kernels then would be germinated, and the good ones would be out about this long.
About 1.5 inches long.
1.5 inches long for the very the good ones. and they'd be those that are dead, why, there they were, showed right there. And those that, and the ears of corn, of course, are all numbered too. And, well.
And this was part of the gospel training?
Yes, that's just to what led to it. Exactly, yes. Mm-hmm. When I got ready to go up on the train, just to complete that part of the story, why, I had to stop up at Storm Lake or anywhere up through Sheldon and so on. I would say
the farmers would turn out to see you.
Yeah, well, the way it was, I guess I better go back and tell how the thing got started. I had tested this corn, 1,200 samples, and found that less than 60% of it would grow in this germination box. You see, well, that was going to be serious. And farmers are in the habit of picking out their ears and throwing them in, guessed it was all right, and so on. I was testing corn, and finally, a committee down in Des Moines, the Chamber of Commerce committee and so forth, called me up and wanted to know if I wouldn't come down to the meeting. Said they were having a homecoming for a man that had been away quite a while, and said, I said, I can't make any speeches. I said, I haven't time. I'm too busy. This corn question has to be tended to now. Oh, he says, just come down. No, you don't have to. Just eat and listen, he said. Well, so I went down. But I suspected the darn rascal. I took one of these germination boxes along. I took one of the German, with the same in here. I didn't even open it to see what was in it, because I knew that there'd be plenty, and set it down just outside the door when I went in. And they called on one man to speak, and he told some funny stories, and just what they were looking for, of course. Finally, the next one, they called on me. Well, sir, I said, my boys, I knew that I could tell from the sound of the voice that I couldn't trust this fellow, and I said, I brought my speech right along. I stepped out and picked this up and looked into them. My God, you ought to have seen them jump out of their seats putting there. And I said, no, keep your seats. Get your seats so that I can show you. And I held it up and showed them. Well, there wasn't more than 6 ears of any one of these three people, you see, in that community. Now I said, there's your picture. And 1,200 of them I've tested. I said, it's no guesswork about it. And, well, they never called on anyone else the rest of that evening. They were so excited, the railroad men and the bankers, why. They could realize what to do to their business, you see.
If farmers planted seeds,
they'd
like grow.
That, yes, that wouldn't grow. And wanted to know what I was going to do about it. Well, I said, I'm going to go out and fit up some bobsleds. There was snow on then in March, February, just the last February. And I said, I'm going to take these germination boxes, and I'm going to take the corn for each one of these stations that I've got, and I'll show them what they got right there. Here it is. And then I said, I'll leave it there so they can all come in and see it afterwards, make one like it. And words don't count when you... farmers with the attitude they had those times, you just had to leave no loopholes. But during the meantime, they got excited down there at Des Moines. And finally, the Rock Island, superintendent for Rock Island wrote, he goes over to Wallace and to others and said, why, this is terrible. They said, he says, what would be the matter of my running the train, taking hold of him up and letting him stop 20 minutes at every station and show him these boxes? And, Uncle Henry said, I'll vouch for Holden if you run your train. Wallace was one that helped get me over to Iowa.
And this is the uncle?
Yeah, Uncle Henry Wallace.
President Henry Wallace.
Yeah, that was his grandfather.
grandfather.
A grandfather of young Henry. And, then they called up and wanted to know if I'd go out on such a train. You know, after they talked it all over. And I said, sure, I'll go. And and I got ready and got things together, got the boxes and everything. And when the time come, here was their schedule. Railroad made out. There was 50 stops in 3 days. Two of them even evening meetings. Now I was, you can see what there was to get in through a day. 20 minutes at each one. Well, first they was going to have me go out and lecture to them out the side of the car. No, I said, you tell them, come right into this car. I want them closer to me. I said, I've got to be where I can hit them from this day. I said, I'm a cruel fella. And I said, one of them said, why can't you get right to this testing quicker and instead of talking in general about some of these things and the importance of it and give it right to them from the first shot. I said, all right, I'll make an agreement with you. If you start this train right from the start on the jump at 30 miles an hour, I'll start my speech at 30 miles an hour. Oh, gee, I guess you'll let you run your lecture. I said, I think that's better. And then they wanted to know if I'd go out and talk. No, I said I'd soon have the horse. February, you know, last February, 1st of March. And no, I said, they're coming right in here where I can look right down into their faces. And I want to see Holmes and Jones, and it's got this corn in the box here. And they'd stop. And I'd say, boys, I know you need my going telling you how careful you are about picking your seed corn. I said, I can see you now getting ready to go out there and grab an ear and throw it in. Oh, that's all right. Yep, I guess that's right. Shell it up and go and plant it. I said, now I'm here to help you, not to amuse you or entertain you. And you've got to take some awful hard medicine. And I hope you'll be good sports enough to take it. And by and by I'd say, well, look, I'll show you something. So I put this box and opened it. I hadn't looked at him at all, but then I knew what to see. And I said, is Holmes here? Man named Holmes? Yes, here he is. Yes, I bought my seed corn of him last year. I said, Holmes, stand up. I want the boys to see you. And I said, here's your corn. Ear number one growing fine. Ear number two, medium. Ear number three is dead. Ear number six is only two kernels growing. And, well, he began to twist around and say, he corn is better than that boy's, and say, be a game, Charlie, be James, be a good sport. I'd already taken occasion to get this set. And I'd say, well, is Mr. Smith here, so-and-so? Yes, here he is. Well, I'd say, Smith, get up, got some medicine for you too. And I'd show it to him. Now I'd say, how would you like to have me leave it up here at the bank?
You're talking about Mr. Smith.
Already? I would call on the third man that had samples of corn in the germination box. And by this time, I didn't have to try to impress them with the fact that their seed corn wasn't good. And then I showed them how they could, I agreed to leave the box right at the bank so that they could all come in and see it. Well, the thing that maybe you'd be surprised, at least it surprised me, was that when I got back to, after this 3 days trip, and I got back to the Ames, to the college, I had editors from the reviews, an American magazine, another, and knocking at my door at 11 and 12 o'clock at night to know what was happening. This idea of going out and taking things to people by train, why, that's a new idea. And they didn't send the reporters, they just came out themselves, the head man. Mm-hmm. And at once, why, what are you calling it? Why, I said, we're just out to inform the to help the farmers to over a serious situation. Well, they went back and some of them proposed the corn gospel trains and it got that name and it went for that on through. Well, then when the headquarters of the Rock Island Road in Chicago, they said to their superintendent, Des Moines, you're getting yourself in here where you'll make monkeys out of us folks if this thing doesn't work out right. And after the first meeting, when was the first meeting, they all hung out the cars to see if there was a soul there to hear the corn talk. And here they was, all farmers were there, my boots on and everything there on the platform. I read in, I had come right into the train, and I then made these talks and so on, just 20 minutes to a place, and had to go on time because there was 50 of them to get out in 3 days. And but it stirred up the whole state. Every other railroad in Iowa immediately began to ask that I should come out and go over their entire lines, the Burlington and the the main line of the Rock Island and that other big road,
Illinois Central.
The Illinois Central, and then the other one that goes through the northern part of the state. And then it extended to other states. I had to go to Kentucky and to Nebraska and to South Dakota and out through the West on their trains. And many of these trains cost a good many $1,000s. When we first went out, we only had one speaking coach and no sleepers on it, and a diner. Yes, we did have a diner, but the crowds got so big that we couldn't get them into one car, so they had to get another car. Well, they finally hadn't gone very far until they had to get a third speaking coach.
And three people speak at once?
At the same time, only, and perfectly quiet, you know, because they were going to the car, doors are closed, and that way you could take about 100. They would generally set three in a seat, and if there was more, they'd sit in the aisleway, down right on the floor and looking up, and they're right down in front of you, because you could go right after them, no echoing, you know. It was the most effective thing, and it was. Now if it had gone up the hall, they wouldn't have thought so much about it, but the idea of coming up and speaking right in a train, it just was so surprising. But there was where this great idea of taking things to the people come, and that's one of the most fundamental things in my whole life's work. Mm-hmm. Going to the people. My proposition was always that you've only got two legs under your stool. You know, for Lincoln's, what someone asked Lincoln one time, which is the most important department of the government, the executive, legislative, or judicial? Well, Lincoln said, I'll answer by asking you a question. Which leg of a three-legged stool is the most important? And I said, that's what you've got. You've got education, teaching the boys that come there. You've got research, experimentation, but you haven't taken it to the people. It isn't working yet. And that's your third leg. And Uncle Henry Wallace, when we had finished coming down over one of the branch lines from Mason City down through and finished the trip up there, and he called me back into their men's businessmen's caboose back there, and said, Holden, we've been talking things over here. He says, everywhere they're hollering for more. When will you come back? That we like this sort of thing. That's giving us real information. And he says, now, Wallace says, what's the future of this thing anyway? Is this all of it? All of it, I said. Why, Wallace, I said, you just haven't begun to scratch the surface. Why, I said, do you know you ought to have a department of this institution whose business it is to go to people, and that they don't have to experiment nor teach these students, their business to go out there and inspire these people to do these very things, I said. This is just a good example of what you'd have dozens of campaigns out, and when there's any emergency come up. And, well, he said, turned to me and he said, would you draft a bill for the establishment of an extension department? I said, Mr. Wallace, I certainly will. And I did. Asked for $50,000 and got $15,000. But that was an achievement. And, you know, new things don't come without some pressure somewhere. And, but all these people, you see, that had had this thing over those trains, why, when I called on them and sent out 100 telegrams to the Appropriations Committee, 90 of them came up. And there's only one thing to do, pass it. Tried every trick to defeat it, the politicians, but they couldn't. And, extension was established, and that was in 1906. See, I'd had these trains through the first year, from 2 to 6. And then I got that established. Well, my 5 years that I had promised to establish the Farm Crops Department was up, and I said, now I'm through, and say goodbye to you folks. You've got the extension now, I'm going to have the extension department. Well, Lord, they went up in their arms, and why they said, the president said, well, we don't know why this would be a white elephant on our job. We don't know how to get at it. We want you to stay, and you say, it's your duty to. So, well, I said, if you really want it. I said, you'll have to pay me more, and I want to understood that I'm going to have 5 years to make it work. If I can't do it in that time, then you ought to get someone else that can. But I said, the idea of going taking this to the people and making it work right out at home, I said, that's fundamental. Well, that led to these demonstration farms and all these other things that got them interested. We planted the corn, took the farmer's corn right out of the planter box. See, we didn't take any chances. Say that, oh, that's isn't my address, that's some other corn I had. Not, we just went right, that was through the county, and we'd get about 80, 90 to 100, generally about 80 farmers, right out of their box, or out the sack that they was taking it right out of. And then we'd take it to the county poor farm, and there planted each man's. Like that block here,
and we had it by side.
Yes, side by side. Yes, and we had a row between. We could cut out so that each one stand up itself. Finally, when we harvested, and then after we got it once, we repeated it again, and then we repeated it again, and then just to take care of the tough ones, we repeated it a fourth time. No loopholes, you see. It's their own corn. Right on the county poor farm, at home, they said, you'll notice what Bliss says about up at Sioux County. Says that asked Mr. Holden at 20th Dean Stewart, do you think your experiments down that Ames will fit up here? And I said, well, there's one way to find out, and that's try it. And so they put in a resolution, asked the board of supervisors to appropriate $500. And I said, I'll bring men up to see to planting it and harvesting it and helping you. And but you'll have to furnish the land and cultivation and everything. And then we'll have a picnic when fall comes and they can see their corn right by one side or the other. Well, now there she was, extension going out to them. Part of that same idea. And county agent work, that's what grew out of that. That was where the county agent was born. Just that little county that said we want someone up right here to
Was that Baldwin that was working with you then?
No, this was at Iowa State.
Yes, and Bliss was one of the boys, and Wilson, that was, come up to visit me from Washington.
Oh, yes.
And Mosher, they were all on my trains, having like they liked it. I could tell you some funny stories about the kids that started out. But by God, it worked. You see, I knew there was more to come, and it's when I established the funk band. That would work up this inbred stuff, and if there was any possibility, why, they wouldn't fire a person for having some nubbins, you see, commercial concern.
Yes.
And up at the college, why, if you went and asked for some money, they would want it for, we got some corn breeding out here, well, you couldn't ever one out tall, And then it'd be like my case, I'd be pulling out maybe right in the critical time. Mm-hmm. Well, I just figured that what we want to do is get someone, like the Funks, with 25,000 acres of land back of it, and sure it's worked out to perfection. But that had to grow. In the meantime, I wanted to get the people corn-minded so that they'd be ready for whatever come. But I couldn't go out and tell them. I wasn't going to tell them things and then have to back up.
No, well, there are a great many problems to be ironed out.
But I knew there was something to it when those things come up there like that from that.
Now, in the 30s, the hybrid seed corn came into its own, and in the 40s, Richard Crabb of Wheaton, Illinois, wrote his book on what is the hybrid corn makers.
Yes, the hybrid corn makers.
And Beale is in there, and Hopkins and Shamel and all the rest, but you're pretty much ignored in that account. Now, I heard Mr. Crabb say a week or so ago when he was here on the campus that when he rewrites the book, you're going to have a different place in us, in the book. Would you tell us about how you discovered the evidence to prove that you had worked with corn at Illinois?
Yes, that is a very interesting story. I perhaps failed to tell you that after I left to the college to go with the sugar company, that the records at the university were destroyed by fire. And that had all of my secret records, you see, it wasn't to get out the public, for burned up. Well, there's a terrible blow, 5 years, my gracious, about as hard work as I ever did anywhere, and yet there it was. Well, I got up in the morning, next morning, and I said, I'm going to work enough harder to make up for that, I'm going to catch that up. And I just said that it's one of those things that comes into a person's life, conditions are such that I've got to take it, because if I'd go out and just my word, you can't argue things, they've got to have something more than that. Well, then when Crabb's book came out and pointed out, as you know, in this paragraph, one paragraph on page 28, calling attention to the fact. See you.
Just a minute. Would you read that? This is the paragraph. There was, however, inbred corn already available for the experiment which East and Love proposed to make. This corn had been inbred by Hopkins as a sort of check study in connection with Hopkins' corn breeding program. Although it was never mentioned in any of the university papers, bulletins, magazine, or newspaper articles reporting upon the Hopkins corn breeding project, an inbreeding program was carried along in connection with it under Hopkins' direction for a decade or more, scanty and time-bleached records at the University of Illinois make it difficult to establish the exact year when this inbreeding work began, but the program had assumed definite and stable proportions by 1901.
When this came out, I became convinced that something ought to be said at this, the facts ought to be known. And as I began to hunt for any evidence, I by accident ran on to 24 photographs that had been lifted by the files after I left, cautiously, by Professor Shamwell, his brother.
Before the fire.
Yes, before the fire. And had given to him, and they were in a book on corn, but no credit given to anyone, just taken out. Then when I had that, and had the photographs that were in there, and you can see on the last two pages, there could be no quarreling. They couldn't anybody say that I didn't do it. There's the F corn, there's the pictures.
Of the
inbred and the crossbred.
Yes, and the difference in size.
Yeah, and two pictures
there,
there's another picture.
With beard and all.
Yeah, I see that.
No question.
And this second one is also a
mistake. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I found it's my duty to just go and tell the story. No, I never told it to anybody excepting my son, Dave, who is associate professor of agronomy at Madison. I had said to him once or twice that I perhaps would write at least the story tell the story, real story, for him and the family. But I didn't want to go out and stir up something that I couldn't prove. And well, of the 250 books of this that I published myself and sent out, I didn't want any question as to this being done for money or anything of that kind. I paid for it myself, and that's offset work. That's no cheap work about it. I'm always bound to try going
neat.
To do it.
I know.
And I sent out 250 of those, and I have received over 500 letters. Well, to run now probably to 600 letters. Those would tell, someone would tell the other fellow, you know, and he'd say, I saw them, but could you send me a copy? I had to have another edition printed, a second edition, so that I've got a few left. You
that
see what leads right up to if someone hadn't had been foolish enough, like I say, to continue that inbreeding down there to the end, when I thought we was getting too clear to the fizzle end of everything, why, someone else had had to done it.
Hmm.
And it'd been 100 years and nobody had done it.
But you, because you had developed those inbred lines, it was possible for hybrid corn.
Yes.
And the interesting thing was that Crabb found these inbred lines in Illinois, and all his research showed that someone had done the work, and what he didn't know was who did it.
Yes.
So he said maybe Hopkins.
Yes,
well, I believe you
he took my position after I left.
Hopkins was a chemist while you were
there. Yes.
And he was in the laboratory, not in the field.
No, not at all. He never went out in the field. Had nothing whatever to do with it.
But he leaves it very clearly, clear gap in the book, and you filled it.
Yes. One reason why I have such an admiration for Crabb is that he's been a good sport. And has taken it.
He took the criticism.
Absolutely. Said the saddest thing in his book and in his career was the fact that he hadn't contacted me or known of my work before he published the book. Well,
And I know he meant that because he said it to me when you weren't present.
Oh, yes. He's become one of my finest friends. And And for that reason, he's just got quality. that fellow. I wish we had him regularly.
Maybe we should know a little bit about who Mr. Crabb is. I don't believe that was brought out.
Could you...
You go right ahead. You know him.
Well, let's see. Mr. Crabb wrote the story entitled Hybrid Coin Makers. And he interviewed all these corn men in throughout the United States that had been improving corn and working on corn, and wrote a very fine book. It is a wonderful story, well written. Nobody else has undertaken to write one. He's the only one that had the nerve to do it. And writing a story about people while they're still alive is ticklish business. Historians would rather wait till they're dead.
I know what you mean.
Talk to you.
But that's a fact. And when you can't help but admire a man that would take his chances. And if we get that, I hope we can get that his record.
Well, you have deposited your papers, Mr. Holden, with the library, and I'm sure that Mr. Crabb intends to.
Oh, he intends to.
His.
Oh, he told me that.
He
finally told me in Chicago. I went to him in Chicago in hopes I'd run on to him, and I did. He heard I was to speak there at the corn meeting, and he sat beside of me at the table, and he turned to me and he said, he had before that told me that he was going to give Illinois a copy of all of his notes and there. And but he turned to me there, and that was the reason I went down there. I was afraid that he'd be doing that very thing. And so I said, well, I'll tell you, I hope that we can go together on the thing. Maybe we can, it'll be an advantage to us. But I said, I kind of am leaning pretty strongly towards MSC. It's my alma mater. And they've taken an interest, shown interest and willing to do something, apparently. And, well, he says, I'll go wherever you go. He says, I want mine to go where, be a part of the exhibit that wherever you put yours. Well, when I decided there, why, he took it, for granted that is where his was going. Oh, he intends to deliver it, I know.
And if we develop then here at Michigan State a Corn Foundation or Corn Memorial Foundation or Mays Institute or whatever it may be called, original credit, of course, for its inception must go to you, Mr. Holden, and for the fact that you deposited with the library so much excellent material that they felt that it was a nucleus for something much larger. And then with the fact that Mr. Crabb from outside considered it worth doing and pushed it as well. And we certainly would have in your papers and Crabb's an excellent nucleus for a collection that should have international fame.
Well, nothing seems to me would be more appropriate under the circumstances than to develop such a collection where it could be available to research students and others that and to regular students, and instead of just being stowed away somewhere under some brick or cement, just simply as a monument, but really make it a working memorial. I think that's, to me, very, very important. And I should, while I haven't talked with Professor Decker and other teachers yet, I would like to in some way have it brought very strongly to their attention the great value there is in a student's going and digging up stuff like that in his work that it gives him a basis that you can't get in any other way. Take Bagley, that, you know, that educated. Why, he attributes all his whole success to the fact that he took this, some of this work that's like this right there, and gave him an idea, another viewpoint, an educational viewpoint. And that it wasn't a question of opinion, it was a question of facts. Did it work or didn't it? He said it gave me a whole new line of activities, work. He, the last letter he wrote me was, he said that in my new book that I'm preparing, in which on master teachers whom I've met, he said, I'm going to put you right up at the top of it all. He said, Dr. Kedzie and some of those others were geniuses and all, but he said they weren't creative geniuses. They hadn't entered a field that was new and that nobody else entered. But he said, that's the danger part for a person to get into. And it's a fact that my whole activities has been taking these danger spots, that they were, if they were important. And my judgment as to whether they were important or not was what it would do for humanity. And as for being discouraged, as someone say, because people didn't adopt them right off, I remind myself, and oftentimes my critics, that the Creator had been working a good many thousands and millions of years to make a perfect world, and I wasn't expecting to do it all in my lifetime. And that I should be very happy indeed if it helped a little. I didn't record him.
It's fine.
We aren't missing a thing today.
Now, what is there in there?
If you shut it off, I want to just suggest another point. Can you shut it?
All right.
Few weeks ago, in fact, a few months ago, I received a letter from Professor Kelly of the University of Kentucky. He is now head of the Agricultural Engineering Department, was a graduate of Ames, Iowa, and his folks lived there at Ames. And one day, a Russian student by the name of Paul Rosenberg came home very much excited one night from school. And Mrs. Kelly said, well, Paul, what is it that excites you so? Why, he said, I had an experience that I never expected to have. He said, you know, I had the experience of fixing Professor Holden's sink for Mrs. Holden. Well, she said, why do you have such an admiration for Professor Holden? Why, he said that he furnished us the material that revived and revised our agriculture, our growing of corn, he says, over in Russia. Why, he says, you know, that the Russian students holds in the highest esteem three people in America. One is Washington, the other is Abraham Lincoln, the other is P.G. Holden. Well, now, of course, it sounds foolish in a way, but I had sent corn way back in this period I'm talking about in Iowa, of these corn trains, corn gospel train. I had sent corn over to Odessa, Russia, to give them a basis for starting on their corn. Then I had sent Michael over as a man to show him how to go corn. And he translated my book into Russian. Mm-hmm.
You'd sent Michael to Russia.
Yeah.
Oh, your book had been translated.
Translated into Russian. And that's a studentship. Oh, he said that the people, he, and this was a remark that he made, that the students of Russia, there's three people the students of Russia hold in great admiration. That was the way of it. And one of them was things and so forth.
Yes.
And they said that, well, why do you have you so much admiration for Professor Holden? Well, he furnished us the literature and furnished us seed corn for developing our work here in Russia. Mm-hmm. Well, then when they wanted to advance their work there, they sent over and asked me if I would come to Russia. And I felt that I ought to remain where I was, carrying out my program. And so I recommended Professor Michael. Still used to go to school to me here in Hastings. He's a graduate of this institution, and one of the most brilliant. And I sent you some literature once about him. And Michael has practically spent his entire life in Russia. And today, he is the top man being consulted down in Washington on Russian matters. Mm.